Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Pedro Alvarez, age 93, from Scottsdale; Eldon Dwayne Cooley, age 82, from Scottsdale; Linda Louise Neuheisel, age 87, from Sun City; and Carl Yost, age 95, from Scottsdale. Turning now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic, big headline on this section: EU power grid needs trillion-dollar upgrade. Blackout followed acceleration in the use of renewable energy. Europe's aging power grid and lack of energy storage capacity will require trillions of dollars in investment to cope with the rising green energy output, increasing electricity demand, and to avoid blackouts. A week ago, Spain and Portugal lost power in their worst blackout. Authorities are investigating the cause, but whatever the findings, analysts and industry representatives say infrastructure investment is essential. The blackout was a wake-up call. It showed that the need to modernize and reinforce Europe's electricity grid is urgent and unavoidable. Christina Ruby, Secretary General at Eurelectric, Europe's Electricity Industry Association, said. The European Union's power grid mostly dates back to the last century and a half. The lines are over 40 years old. Rising low-carbon energy production and booming demand from data centers and electric vehicles require an overhaul of the grids that also need digital protection to withstand cyber attacks. While global investment in renewables has nearly doubled since 2010, investment in grids has barely changed, at around $300 billion a year. The amount needs to double by 2030 to over $600 billion a year to cover the necessary overhauls, according to the International Energy Agency. Spain asked its own investigators and European Union regulators to investigate the outage on April 28th. While the underlying issues have yet to become clear, grid operator Red Eléctrica said two separate incidents had triggered the massive power loss. It follows an acceleration in renewable energy use, especially in Spain, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February in 2022 and the resulting disruption of oil and gas supplies focused EU efforts on reducing dependence on fossil fuel. The share of renewables rose to 47% in the EU's power mix last year, from 34% in 2019. While fossil fuels dropped to 29% from 39%, data from the think tank Ember showed. Spain plans to phase out coal and nuclear power. Renewable generation hit a record high at 56% of Spain's power mix in 2024. Wind and solar projects are relatively quick to build compared with grids, which can take more than a decade. Part of the problem is the huge sums and complexity of improving a grid over a large distance. The European Commission has estimated Europe needs to invest $2 to $2.3 trillion in grids by 2050. Last year, European firms invested 80 billion euros, that's $90.5 billion, in grids, up from 50 to 70 billion in previous years, analysts at Bruegel said, while adding investments may need to rise to $100 billion. Spain and Portugal's power systems are among those in Europe that lack connections to other grids that can provide backup. Spain needs more links to France and Morocco, said José Luis Domínguez García from Spain's Energy Research Center, RIEC, in Catalonia. Spain has only 5% of connections outside of the Iberian Peninsula, he added. As some other countries also lag, the European Commission has a target to increase interconnection to 15% by 2030 from a previous goal of 10%, meaning each EU member country should be able to import at least 15% of its power production capacity from neighboring countries. Spain will reinforce connections with France, including a new link via the Bay of Biscay that will double the interconnection capacity between the two countries, Spain's grid Red Eléctrica said on April 29th. As solar and wind generation grows, the challenges go beyond upgrading grids to the need for backup generation. Solar and wind farms generate direct current power, while traditional gas or nuclear plants generate alternating current. DC power is converted to AC in inverters to standard 50 Hz frequency for European grids and use in homes and businesses. If power generation drops, the grid requires backup AC power to prevent the frequency from dropping. In the event frequency drops, automatic safety mechanisms disconnect some generation to prevent overheating damage to transformers or transmission lines. If too many plants drop off at the same time, the system can experience a blackout. Before last week's outage, Spain had suffered power glitches, and industry officials had repeatedly warned of grid instability. Spain's energy officials have also said the country's plans to shut down all seven of its nuclear reactors by 2035 could put power supply at risk. Portugal has only two backup plants, a gas and a hydro plant, able to quickly respond if the grid needs more power, Portugal's Prime Minister Luís Montenegro said on April 29th, adding that the country wants more. In Britain, a blackout in 2019 cut power to a million customers when a lightning strike and a second unrelated incident lowered the frequency of the grid. Since then, the country has invested to expand battery storage and had around 5 gigawatts of capacity installed at the end of 2024, according to industry association Renewable UK. It can help balance the grid in the same way as power plants. Europe has 10.8 gigawatts of battery storage, and it will grow to 50 gigawatts by 2030, much less than the required 200 gigawatts, according to the European Association for the Storage of Energy. In Ireland, Siemens Energy has built the world's largest flywheel, which can also operate as power storage and help to stabilize the grid. Continuing with the business section in today's Arizona Republic, report: Shell studying merits of buying BP. Stock price a likely factor in acquisition decision. Shell is working with advisors to evaluate a potential acquisition of rival BP, though it is waiting for further stock and oil price declines before deciding whether to pursue a bid, Bloomberg News reported on May 3rd, citing people familiar with the matter. The oil giant has been more seriously discussing the feasibility and merits of a takeover with its advisors in recent weeks, the report said, adding that any final decision will likely depend on whether the rival stock continues to slide. For several years, BP and Shell were almost equal in size, but over the past few years, Shell has grown to almost twice the size of BP, with a market value of about £149 billion. On May 2nd, when asked about a possible takeover bid for BP, Shell executive Wael Sawan told the Financial Times he would rather buy back more Shell stock. A Shell spokesman confirmed the comments. When asked on an earnings call about Shell's capacity to launch sizable acquisitions, he said, "We have to have our own house in order and have more work to do, despite progress over the past couple of years." A takeover of its crosstown London rival would make Shell an even bigger force in the global energy industry, giving it scale to rival the likes of Exxon and Chevron. A merger would also certainly invite regulatory scrutiny, considering the size of the deal. Shell this week reported strong first quarter results, surpassing profit expectations, and launched a $3.5 billion share buyback. Shell must also wait for BP to reach out for another suitor to make a first move, and its current work could help it get prepared for such a scenario, some of the people told Bloomberg News. Deliberations are in the early stages, and Shell may opt to focus on share buybacks and bolt-on acquisitions rather than a mega merger, the report added. As we have said many times before, We are sharply focused on capturing the value in Shell through continuing to focus on performance, discipline, and simplification, a Shell spokesman said when asked about the report. BP declined to comment. And the last item in the business section today, OpenAI to remain under nonprofit control. ChatGPT creator OpenAI said it would remain under the control of its nonprofit parent while pushing ahead with plans to change the structure of its for-profit arm to allow more capital raising to keep pace in the artificial intelligence race. The announcement follows a storm of criticism and legal challenges, including a high-profile lawsuit filed by rival and co-founder Elon Musk, who has accused OpenAI of straying from its founding mission to develop AI for the benefit of humanity. We made the decision for the nonprofit to stay in control after hearing from civic leaders and having discussions with the offices of the Attorneys General of California and Delaware, the startup said in a blog post on May 5th. It added it would work with major backer Microsoft, regulators, and newly appointed nonprofit commissioners to finalize the updated plan. OpenAI had outlined plans in December to convert its for-profit arm into a public benefit corporation, a structure designed to balance shareholder returns with social goals. The move was intended to help the startup raise more capital and ease restrictions tied to its nonprofit parent, but it sparked concerns over whether the company would fairly allocate assets to the nonprofit and how it would balance profit-making with its mission to develop AI for the public good. On May 5th, OpenAI said the nonprofit parent will control the public benefit corporation and become a big shareholder in it. Brett Taylor, chairman of OpenAI's board, said that the announcement means that the startup will continue to have a structure extremely close to the current one. CEO Sam Altman described it as a compromise that works well enough for investors that they're happy to continue to fund us to a degree we think we'll need. OpenAI has been looking to make changes to attract further investment. It announced in March it would raise up to $40 billion in a new funding round led by SoftBank Group at a $300 billion valuation. The round was contingent on the AI firm transitioning to for-profit status by the end of the year. Altman said OpenAI would still be able to receive funding from the Japanese tech investor after the move. The announcement raises questions over the future of Musk's lawsuit, which sought to block OpenAI's transition away from nonprofit control, among other claims. A jury trial had been scheduled for March 2026. A consortium led by Musk had also made an unsolicited $97.4 billion bid for OpenAI earlier this year that was swiftly rebuffed by Altman with a no thank you. The Tesla CEO owns a competing AI startup, xAI, launched in 2023. Turning now to the sports section in today's Arizona Republic, the top of the page headline, Carroll adds fire to his throws. For at least the third time this season, the Diamondbacks' Corbin Carroll unleashed a throw on Monday night that made you want to double-check your scorecard. Coming in on a shallow fly ball, he fired a one-hop strike to home plate to cut down a base runner trying to tag. Wait, is that really Carroll in right field? It was him all right, and he was showing off his much-improved throwing arm. To be clear, no one is confusing Carroll for O'Neill Cruz. On average, he still possesses one of the weaker arms of any right fielder in the majors. But this much is also true. It's much better than it was before, and the teams have been learning that the hard way. In Washington, during the first road trip of the season, Carroll threw out the Nationals' Nathaniel Lowe, who was trying to score from second on a single to right. More recently, on the Diamondbacks' previous homestand, he threw out the Braves' Alex Verdugo at the plate after tracking down a fly ball in foul territory. All three throws were similar. They were clean, one-hop strikes to the catcher. In years past, teams probably would have been rewarded for their aggressiveness, which was what Carroll had hoped to put an end to as he worked to improve his throwing over the past two winters. I would just say that kind of my goal going into this offseason was not necessarily make the arm a strength, but just to try to make it somewhat average, Carroll said. For me, With where I was last year, getting it to an above-average arm was probably too lofty of a goal. But if I can minimize teams taking advantage of something like that, coming out of the off-season, that's where I feel like it would be a successful one. Carroll said there was once a time when he had a fairly strong arm, at least relative to his peers. But when he was 13, he hurt his elbow playing in a tournament in Palm Springs, California. He said he wound up subconsciously altering his throwing mechanics to protect from further injury. This winter, he said he found a routine, including using weighted balls, that has begun to yield positive results. He laughed when thinking about a day this past January when he wondered if he had pushed too hard. I was like, shoot, I might have overdone it. I don't know if I'm going to be able to throw when the season starts, he said. But after that kind of settled down, I would say that right now the strength is a lot better than it was last year. It also feels better. It feels stronger and healthy. Though his batted ball numbers have increased this year, Carroll has always been known for his ability to generate loud contact despite his relatively undersized frame. He creates massive torque from the ground up, leading to good bat speed and high exit velocities. Carroll said he felt if he could swing hard, he ought to be able to throw hard too, or at least throw harder than he had been. I feel like if you can move well, you can move well, and it should translate from different aspects, he said. Generating some of the force that I do hitting, I feel like there was more in the tank than what I was giving it with my throwing. As a rookie in 2023, Carroll's throws averaged 83.3 miles per hour. Last year, he was at 82.6 miles per hour. This year, it's up to 85.7 miles per hour. His throw on Monday night to nail Tyrone Taylor at the plate was clocked at 95.6 miles per hour, by far the hardest throw he's made in his career. His previous high was 89.9 miles per hour. Corbin is hardworking in the areas of his game that he knows need work, Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovello said. I know that he's on a crusade to complete his game. Once he gets there, he's probably never going to stop and say he's finally done. I know the arm strength has been improving and it's been a lot of hard work. I think there's a little more fire coming from behind that ball. Continuing with the Diamondbacks. Diamondbacks relax and prepare in clubhouse with puzzle battles. Step into the Arizona Diamondbacks clubhouse and visitors won't be greeted by cleats or gloves. In this MLB sanctuary, it's different. Sitting in roughly half of the lockers is something else. Puzzles of the crossword and Sudoku kind. Many of the Diamondbacks players start their day with a puzzle even before preparing to practice or play in a ball game. I won't let myself eat until I finish the puzzle, Diamondbacks pitcher Bryce Jarvis said. For many of them, Sudoku puzzles are just a fun way to pass time before the next activity. Players arrive at the clubhouse as early as 7:30 a.m., with workouts scheduled for 10 a.m. With at least 2 hours to mentally prepare, the players compete against each other or themselves before the real competition starts. It's just downtime, and you'll drive yourself crazy staring at a wall or waiting for whatever's next on the schedule, Jarvis said. For Brandon Fott, games of Sudoku serve more than just one purpose. Along with passing time, Fott says that the puzzles help create different strategies within his mind that help translate to his pitching. I think that's just for fun, to kill time, and a lot of people love them, Fott said. Me, personally, I'm not a crossword guy, but I'm a Sudoku guy. I'll go over there every once in a while and crush those. Staying calm and having those different strategies. There's so many different strategies in Sudoku, and as you get sped up, you can get off track pretty easily. Sudoku has an ancient history, dating back to the 1890s. A Paris newspaper, Le Siècle, began to create the puzzles. By 1979, a modern version of Sudoku began to appear in the U.S. Studies suggest that the definitive number of solutions in a classic puzzle is 5,472,730,538, according to mathematicians and Sudoku experts. Created by Arthur Wynn, crossword puzzles also share a rich history. In December 1913, the first crossword appeared in the U.S. in the New York World. The game became an instant hit. Less than 10 years later, nearly every American newspaper had daily crossword puzzles in their paper. Similar to Sudoku or crossword puzzles, baseball is a game of strategy. Coaches have to make lineups each night along with what pitchers will throw that night. With 9 batters in the lineup each night, that means the manager has 40,320 different ways that he can set up his lineup in a single game. Multiply that by 162 games, and there are 6,531,840 different possible batting orders over the course of a regular season. For someone who doesn't have to create the lineup, like Fott, he has to fight many mental battles within games instead, from pitch selection to the roller coaster of emotions that comes with giving up runs, hits, and striking out batters. Jarvis agrees with Fott in the sense that Sudoku and crossword puzzles are a good test of mental capacities early in the morning. Baseball is a mental game, and as long as you are doing something to test that capacity, I think it's good, Jarvis said. Not only are the puzzles a good test of mental capacity in the morning, but they can also help emotionally after games. Dr. Jonathan Katz, a sports psychologist from New York, said that the routine can help emotionally ground players who may be fighting mental battles. I think what a routine does is it stabilizes and provides a foundational grounding effect, kind of emotionally for players, Katz said. Because if they follow that, it's like whether I went 4-for-4 or 0-for-4 in my previous game, back to my plan, my process, my routine, my discipline. And that can be very calming as you stack those kind of days on top of each other. It keeps the athlete often from the emotional volatility associated with performance volatility. Crossword puzzles and Sudoku puzzles have proven to help with mental capacity and attention span. A 2019 study by the National Institute of Health found that both games improved the brain's prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for planning, attention, decision-making, and social cognition. Not only does the PFC help in the realm of attention span, but it can aid in many other baseball-related areas, including decision-making and problem-solving. Dr. Brooke Shuley, a sports psychologist based in Scottsdale, also noted this about the benefits. There's a lot of evidence that doing cognitively engaging tasks like Sudoku or things like that can help improve attention, Shuley said. And so you'll see a lot of guys, whether it's basketball, baseball, football, that will do certain tasks or skills that improve attention before going out on the court or the field. As for other Diamondbacks players, the puzzles serve as a way to get some competitive juice flowing. Crossword puzzles in particular get harder as the week progresses. Monday's puzzles provide the easiest hints, while Sunday will be the hardest. Throughout the Diamondbacks clubhouse, there are several desk-like seating areas where players sit and complete games. Pitcher Kyle Backus and second baseman Tim Tawa are particularly competitive in their one-on-one race to see who finishes the fastest. I think it's a good start to the day. You know it gets the mind warmed up a little bit and also just a little bit of competition, Tawa said. On the other hand, Backus claimed that he is one of the better Sudoku players on the team. Personally, I think I'm better at Sudoku than some of the guys, so I kind of rub it in their faces a little bit. But they are way better than me at crosswords, Backus said. That's directed at Tim Tawa because he tries to get under my skin a little bit with the crosswords. Although many claim to be the master of these puzzles, two Diamondbacks have earned respect team-wide. Jarvis and former bullpen coach Mike Fetters. Jarvis is good. I'd say he's the best I've seen, Diamondbacks pitcher Joe Mantiply said. The best I've ever seen was our old bullpen coach, Mike Fetters. He's been doing them for like 30 years, so he pretty much knows all of them. Jarvis doesn't disagree. On a good day, I could probably knock it out in like 6 or 7 minutes. Pretty much you don't lift the pen, he said. On a bad day, I'll be 12, 13 minutes. But Jarvis didn't become the best overnight. He lived by the motto of, to become the best, you have to learn from the best. I would do them, the puzzles, with my grandparents growing up, Jarvis said. We would be at their house for Thanksgiving or Christmas, and my grandparents would be into them. I wasn't a whole lot of help then, but they would make me feel good when I got the easy clues. But now I can get involved myself, so it's way more fun that way. Now that he has the knowledge from his grandparents, the Diamondbacks' master puzzler has a competitive edge against his teammates. I mean, doing them for a while definitely helps out. They repeat a lot, you can kind of understand the lingo that goes with the clues, but I've always had a knack for puzzles and games, he said. In a game defined by mental duels and razor-thin margins, it turns out that the Diamondbacks are winning by keeping their minds sharp, one puzzle at a time. And turning to some Suns news, General Manager Gregory is excited to begin his new Suns role. First hire, first draft, first major trade, James Jones established himself as the Phoenix Suns general manager by hiring Monty Williams as head coach and acquiring Cam Johnson in the 2019 draft. Jones also added Dario Saric and landed Chris Paul in a trade before the 2021 season. Those three moves were huge in the Suns reaching the 2021 NBA Finals after winning just 19 games two seasons earlier in 2018-19. Williams coached the team. Paul was the catalyst for Phoenix's run to the finals, while Johnson and Saric were rotational players. Now, Brian Gregory will have an opportunity to do the same as Phoenix's new GM. He's replacing Jones, who remains with the franchise as a senior advisor. I'm honored to be named the new general manager of the Phoenix Suns in this unbelievable community with a great fan base, Gregory said. The Phoenix Suns, one of the greatest franchises of the NBA, 30 years of basketball has brought me to this position, and I'm excited about this opportunity that's in front of me. Gregory has had his introductory news conference on Tuesday, May 6th, at the team's practice facility. He served as the team's vice president of player programming this past season after joining the front office in 2023 as a consultant. Been very, very pleased with the roles I've played in this organization the past 2 years, Gregory continued. I love Phoenix. I love the community, and I'm very excited about what's next and what we're going to build here. The Suns are in the middle of a coaching search under Gregory to replace Mike Budenholzer, who was fired after one season. Phoenix finished 36-46 and failed to make the playoffs for the first time since 2020, which was the last time it had a losing record. That's the first order of business for Gregory. Find a head coach, something team owner Matt Ishbia has vowed the Suns will get right this time. This will be their fourth head coach in four seasons. We're going to make sure we cast a wide net on that and at the same time evaluate and interview coaches from a diverse background with diverse experiences and so forth, said Gregory about the coaching search as he didn't put a timetable on making the hire. The 2025 NBA draft is next month. Gregory played a role in the Suns landing Ryan Dunn late in the first round of last year's draft and Oso Iguodaro in the second round. Dunn and Iguodaro became rotational players for the Suns, taking on the challenge of guarding and opposing the team's top offensive perimeter player. The defensive-minded Dunn averaged 6.9 points and 3.6 rebounds in 76 games last season, with 44 starts. Iguodaro played 61 games with 6 starts and averaged 4.2 points and 3.6 rebounds. He shot 60.4% from the field and, at 6'10", displayed a skill set of a ball handler and screener who could find the open man off the roll or finish around the basket. Phoenix enters this year's draft with the 29th pick in the first round and the 52nd pick in the second round. Phoenix will enter summer looking to make changes to a roster that underachieved with Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, and Bradley Beal. They entertain trade possibilities involving Durant before the 2025 trade deadline and are expected to engage in talks later this summer. Durant is entering the final year of his $194 million contract. Beal has a no-trade clause, but the Suns have had success they envisioned when pairing him up with Booker and Durant going into the 2023-24 season. Phoenix won 49 games to land the sixth seed, but were swept in the first round by Minnesota. Jones played 14 NBA seasons and won 3 NBA championships before joining the Suns' front office as vice president of basketball operations shortly after his final season in the league as a player in 2016-17. 2 years later, he became the Suns' GM after serving as an interim GM, replacing Ryan McDonough. After winning the 2021 NBA Executive of the Year Award, Jones was promoted to President of Basketball Operations and remained the team's general manager. Gregory doesn't have Jones's NBA background. He never played in the NBA, but has spent 2 years in the Suns' front office, following 19 seasons as head coach at the NCAA division level. And we'll take a look at some sports briefs before we leave this section. Cavaliers' Kenny Atkinson is named NBA Coach of the Year. It only took Kenny Atkinson one season to make a splash in the Eastern Conference, and he was rewarded handsomely as the Cleveland Cavaliers frontman was named the NBA Coach of the Year. It was announced on Monday. Atkinson, who guided the Cavs to 64 wins and the number one seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs, beat out J.B. Bickerstaff of the Detroit Pistons and Ime Udoka of the Houston Rockets. Interestingly, Atkinson took over Cleveland after the team fired Bickerstaff last May. The Cavaliers recorded the franchise's second most regular season wins under Atkinson, who joins Bill Fitch from 1976 and Mike Brown from 2009 as the only Cleveland coaches to win the honor. The 64 victories also tied for the fourth most by a head coach in his first season with the team. After Atkinson left an assistant coach position with Golden State Warriors to take over in Cleveland, the Cavaliers won their first 15 games of the season to equal the second-best start in NBA history. They also strung together a team-record 16 wins spanning February and March. In addition, Cleveland saw Evan Mobley establish himself as a force down low, becoming the first Cavalier to win Defensive Player of the Year. And Horschel to have hip surgery, dealing blow to Ryder Cup hopes. Billy Horschel announced on Tuesday he's set to undergo hip surgery next week, dealing a blow to his hopes of playing for the United States in this year's Ryder Cup. World number 24 Horschel, who 2 weeks ago withdrew from the PGA Tour's Zurich Classic of New Orleans team event due to injury, made the decision to have the surgery in Colorado. It's an unfortunate situation with so many great events left on the calendar, but this is a preventative measure, Horschel, 38, said in a video posted on X, formerly known as Twitter. I'm already looking forward to getting the rehab started, getting back to practicing and hopefully returning to the golf course in late summer, early fall. Horschel, who played on the winning President's Cup team in 2022, has two top tens in the 12 events this year and is 16th on the U.S. Ryder Cup point standings. The Ryder Cup is scheduled for September 26th to 28th at Bethpage Black in New York. And the Big 12 Conference has approved a 3-year contract extension for Commissioner Brett Yormack on Tuesday, multiple outlets reported on Tuesday. ESPN first reported that the board of directors had extended his original 5-year deal, which was set to expire in 2027. Yormark, age 58, succeeded Bob Bowlsby in 2022. He helped the Big 12 navigate a national realignment of the conference landscape and boost its membership to coincide with the departures of Texas and Oklahoma to the Southeastern Conference. Yormark landed a new $2.3 billion television deal with ESPN and Fox in 2022 and shepherded the 2024 editions of four former Pac-12 members, Colorado, Arizona, Arizona State, and Utah. He also oversaw the previously negotiated expansion that brought BYU, Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF into the fold in 2023. Yormack was the CEO of Jay-Z's entertainment company, Roc Nation, before taking over the Big 12. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And turning to the columns and opinions section of today's Arizona Republic, we'll begin with E.J. Montini, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Trump either played dumb or lied about his sworn oath. In April, Donald Trump bragged about passing a test used to screen for dementia, saying, "I got the highest mark," as if an examination in which an individual has to identify a tiger and draw a clock is an intelligence test instead of an effort to discern cognitive decline. But given the fact that he aced the exam, I'd guess Trump remembers his inauguration in January. And I'm guessing he recalls how during that ceremony, he held up his right hand and swore an oath that was administered by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Trump said, "I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will do the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God." So it was a bit puzzling to hear Trump not seem to remember that oath during a May 4th interview with Meet the Press moderator Kristen Welker, particularly the part where Welker asked the president if he needed to uphold the Constitution, and he said, "I don't know." Don't know? Melania was standing next to him holding a couple of Bibles when he raised his right hand and swore to Chief Justice John Roberts and all Americans that he would preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And now he's saying he doesn't know. And it's not even the first time he had sworn the same oath. Trump did so back in 2016, too. Same words. Of course, it's fairly well known that Trump has trouble over the years with oaths. Clearly, a guy on his third wife didn't exactly embrace the "until death do us part" line in the marriage vows. Then there are the 4,000 or so lawsuits that Trump has been part of, including the time he sued author Timothy L. O'Brien over his book, Trump Nation, The Art of Being Donald. During a deposition in that lawsuit, Trump was made to acknowledge under oath that he hadn't told the truth 30 different times, ranging in subjects from the cost of a membership to one of his golf clubs, to his wealth, to the rate for his speaking appearances, to how many condos he has sold, to the debt he owed, and to whether he borrowed money from his family to stave off personal bankruptcy. Now comes his conversation with Welker, where, initially, he claimed ignorance about the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which he swore to preserve, protect, and defend. Welker was talking about the people being shipped off to prison in El Salvador without due process. "Do you agree," she asked, "that everyone who is here deserves due process, citizens and non-citizens?" Trump said, "I don't know. I'm not a lawyer." Actually, you don't need to be a lawyer to read and understand the simple language of the Fifth Amendment, which says, "No person will be made to answer for a crime without due process of law." It's the kind of thing a middle schooler would learn in civics lesson. Welker pointed this out, saying, "The Fifth Amendment says as much. Don't you need to uphold the Constitution?" To which Trump replied, "I don't know." "Really? Because the rest of us do." That was written by E.J. Montini for the Arizona Republic. You can reach him, if you'd like to, at ed.montini@arizonarepublic.com. The next column is by Phil Boas, columnist for the Arizona Republic. I expected a Trump beating in Sedona. It never happened. I tuned into the McCain Institute's annual Sedona Forum this past weekend, expecting a purge. We are now 100-plus days into the second Trump presidency, and many of the people lined up for that conference lean left. They are no doubt appalled at what they see as Trump's assault on the Atlantic Alliance, the global economy, and the U.S. Constitution. I expected them to unload on Donald Trump. I could not have been more wrong. Instead, I walked away expressing my hopefulness to friends and family that I had just watched how America moves past our hyper-partisanship and extreme politics. When I say extreme politics, I mean both right and left. Both have been highly corrosive to our country. The McCain Institute at Arizona State University in many ways reflects John McCain's legacy as a foreign policy interventionist. He loved geopolitics more than any other part of the job description of U.S. Senator. These were the issues that most animated him, because McCain was a big-picture guy who left the trifling details to others. When he spoke about the world, he did so with confidence and a good deal of firsthand experience. But the McCain Institute is an incomplete reflection of John McCain's legacy. He was a party man who declared it would be a cold day in Gila Bend before he ever left the GOP. He voted reliably conservative despite his well-publicized maverick moments. The institute in his name at Arizona State University is overseen mostly by centrist to center-left figures, such as his wife and chairman emeritus, Cindy McCain, who campaigned for Joe Biden and served as his ambassador to the United Nations Agencies for Food and Agriculture, and Evelyn Farkas, an Obama appointee in the Defense Department, who later ran for Congress in New York as a Democrat. John McCain worked comfortably across the aisle, so none of this would have vexed him. But don't expect the McCain Institute to ever celebrate his stand against abortion or in support of the Second Amendment. The McCain Institute is likely to become, as its namesake, a ferocious opponent of government big spending. That is not its mission. Had it been, John McCain would have made it such when he worked with ASU to create the think tank in 2012. The McCain Institute reflects John McCain's vision of promoting democracy and freedom across the globe to make everyone on it safer. Today, there are two principal adversaries to that McCain vision: Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Donald Trump. What I saw in the Sedona conference is that Xi's China is about to become the dominant organizing principle for the American people, who have no choice but to come together and start shoring up our country as a bulwark for freedom and security in the 21st century. Speaker after speaker alluded to an emerging China as the great challenge of our age, in that its ruling Communist Party is working to reshape the world in its authoritarian image. This is not the old Cold War. The Chinese are not the Red Menace. They long ago replaced their command economy with a free market hybrid that takes them beyond doctrinaire communism. But it is a one-party authoritarian state that is forming an axis with other authoritarian states in defiance of the free world. In the May 2nd Q&A in Sedona, Admiral Samuel Paparo, the top American military commander in the Indo-Pacific, made international news when he said the U.S. military can stop a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. The United States will prevail in the conflict as it stands right now with the force that we have right now, he said. But he warned that we're on a bad trajectory. China is building up its arsenal much faster than the United States. China produces 2 submarines a year for every 1.4 made in the U.S., and 6 combatant warships for every 1.8 manufactured in America, as reported by the Financial Times. If there was an 800-pound gorilla at the Sedona conference, it wasn't Trump, it was Xi. A discussion that was headlined "Signal in the Noise, Cybersecurity, Intelligence, and Data" sounded like it was teed up to drive Trump into the far horizon. The moderator was Shane Harris, staff writer for The Atlantic, whose editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg became news when Trump officials mistakenly invited him to their Signal work group. In that work group, new Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared critical details about an ensuing U.S. military attack on the Houthis. On the Sedona panel to discuss this inexcusable breakdown was Arizona's U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, a fierce critic of Trump and Hegseth. I was certain Kelly would send both flying down the fairway. But while Kelly criticized them, he and other panelists ultimately moved on to China and the threat it poses to the United States and the world. Kelly explained how the Chinese are using cyber espionage on American infrastructure to potentially defeat us in a great power struggle that could grow hot with an invasion of Taiwan. The Chinese have embedded their coding in American telecom corporations, Kelly said. They're still there, and we've yet to figure out a way to kick them off. They have also embedded rogue coding in American utilities. Imagine, for example, that U.S. forces at Fort Drum, New York, are mobilized at the same moment the water and sewer system shut down on their base, Kelly said. Chaos would ensue. The point being that the signal breakdown matters because we have committed enemies who are actively penetrating our internet systems to wreak havoc and intercept our most sensitive government secrets. Also on the panel was Sue Gordon, who served as the nation's top career intelligence officer. She worked for presidents from both parties over 3 decades. She pointed to the extreme partisanship that now consumes Washington and leads to suspicion of career government workers who are supposed to carry forward institutional knowledge and expertise, no matter which party controls the White House. "I spent a lifetime in front of Senator McCain," she recalled. "In that time, there were days we thought we were awesome, and days we thought we were missing the mark." But there wasn't a single day he didn't know we were there for America. We're going to have to restore that spirit in the country, not because it will salve the political culture, but because experience and deep knowledge will be essential in an age of great powers threats. In another panel, U.S. Representative Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, said China has not faced a reckoning for its role in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Ukrainian army had largely defeated the Russians on the battlefield, he explained. Were it not for Chinese industrial support, armaments, microchips, and know-how, Russia wouldn't be able to do what it's doing, which is continuing the illegal invasion of a neighboring country, waging the biggest European land war since World War II, leveling cities and killing citizens, and, as U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar pointed out, removing some 20,000 Ukrainian children from their homeland and placing them with Russian families. This is obviously a humanitarian travesty that is going on, Klobuchar said. These kids should be released before there is a peace deal. With the atrocities of that war backed by the financial and material support of Xi Jinping, our question now, Crow said, is do we have the will to say enough is enough? Should there be economic and diplomatic consequences for China's support of this illegal war? On the same panel, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, national leader of the Republic of Belarus, who has led pro-democracy movements, said it is important for the West to maintain the transatlantic alliance. This unity is being tested by dictatorship. It's crucial that you stand united and stand principled. When you see this uncertainty in your relationship, it frightens us. John McCain would have understood. He made the very point throughout his life, but more poignantly to the World Affairs Council in Los Angeles in 2008. The United States cannot lead by virtue of its power alone, he said. We must be strong politically, economically, and militarily, but we must also lead by attracting others to our cause, by demonstrating once again the virtues of freedom and democracy. One of those responsibilities is to be a good and reliable ally to our fellow democracies. Those are rallying words for a country and an institute that must now work to rebuild our alliances, being shaken first by the world's dictators and then by an American president who does not understand the necessity of friends in a world that grows more dangerous. And that was written by Phil Boas, editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. You can email him at phil.boas at arizonarepublic.com. And now time to look at your horoscope for today. If you're in Aries, born March 21st to April 19th, making headway, you're cool, calm, and collected as the moon and sun harmonize. Obstacles evaporate, strengthening your sense of security. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, feeling good in your skin? The moon and the sun's harmonious connection provides a confidence boost. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, in need of a little you time? No problem. You couldn't have chosen a better day for self-care. For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, putting out fires in your social network? Of course you are. Everyone has you on speed dial for crisis management. For Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, achieving professional recognition? As the moon and sun harmonize, making a boss move boosts your reputation. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, where do you see yourself a year from now? Make plans for your future as the moon and sun harmonize. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, ready to make some changes? As the moon and sun harmonize, pinpoint the source of your dissatisfaction. For Scorpio, October 24th to November 21st, achieving a compromise? Negotiations are a breeze as the moon and sun harmonize. A loved one shows their appreciation. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, shameless self-promotion. There's no harm in talking a big game as the moon and sun harmonize. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, take a load off. As the moon and sun harmonize, the universe gives you permission to play. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, harmony at home? an intimate gathering is overdue. Spend today spilling tea with your most trusted confidants. And finally, for Pisces, February 19th to March 20th, easy relating. Communication is a cinch as the moon and sun harmonize. Just be yourself. And now to today's Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I haven't had a holiday with my grown daughter, Charlie, not her real name, since she left the state 12 years ago. When she came out as a lesbian, I wasn't very accepting and didn't handle it well. I've since apologized. Charlie and her partner refuse to visit here unless I allow them to share the same bed in my house. I say they can't tell me what to do in my own home, just as I can't tell them what to do in theirs. I stayed with them once and they slept in the same bed. Now they no longer invite me to stay there. Charlie told me her partner is uncomfortable with anyone staying there. I haven't spoken to my daughter about their relationship in many years. My heart is broken. I don't get any holidays with them, but her partner's parents are there every year and live in the next neighborhood. I don't understand. Any suggestions? Signed, Missing Her, in Texas. Dear Missing Her, I do have one. If the three of you can decide to be civil with each other during a visit, tell your daughter you'd be willing to stay in a hotel while you're there. Frankly, it might be more comfortable for everyone if they agree to it. And dear Abby, I was married for 19 years. We're divorced and have no contact. Divorce was a good choice. Now, 2 years later, I'm in love with a new man. I'll call Grayson. We've been together for 4 months, and things are going really well. Grayson is gentle and loving in every respect. He's the only man who's never raised a hand to me. We do a lot together and never argue. We both work. We talked about marriage. I've met his family, and I was easily accepted. Is this fate? Destiny? And should I say yes? Signed, Struggling with a Loving Man. Dear Struggling, because you have a history of choosing men who have raised a hand to you, let me advise you that you and Grayson are in the honeymoon phase of your relationship. It's a little early to be talking about marriage. Whether this is fate or destiny, I can't opine. As to whether you should say yes, assuming he has proposed, you'd be wise to have a long engagement to be absolutely sure that gentle, loving Grayson is exactly who he seems to be. And dear Abby, I've been developing feelings for my coworker slash boss. I believed those feelings may have been reciprocated. Then I was fired because of a conflict with another coworker. This happened more than a month ago. I still think about the guy from time to time. I'd like to reach out and let him know without it being embarrassing or seeming creepy, but I'm not sure how. I really care about him. Signed, Former Employee in Connecticut. Dear former employee, if your feelings for your former boss had been reciprocated, he would be reaching out to you, which hasn't happened. That said, if you'd like another conversation with him, contact him and ask him if he's willing to be a job reference if he's contacted by any prospective employers. If you'd like to contact Dear Abby, you can reach her at www.dearabby.com. And time now for some comics from today's Arizona Republic. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood is home from work. He's walking in, carrying his briefcase, talking to Blondie. He says, "The boss came up with a new slogan today to inspire us, and boy, did it work." He says, "It's amazing how inspirational a catchy slogan can be." Blondie says, "What was it?" Dagwood says, "Get inspired or you're fired." In Zits, Jeremy's talking to his mom. Says, "Remember when you used to read me bedtime stories?" And she says, "Sure." And then it shows where they're standing, which is Jeremy's bedroom, which is completely messy. And she says, "I also remember coming in here didn't require a tetanus shot." And Jeremy goes, "Good times." In Pickles, Opal is bending down, talking to her dog, Roscoe. She says, "Oof, Roscoe, you stink. What disgusting thing have you been wallowing in? The dirty clothes bin? The garbage? Muffin's litter box?" She bends down a little closer and realizes what it is and says, "Earl's stinky aftershave." And he's got lines of odor coming up off his back. In Pearls Before Swine, Pig is sitting at the counter with a cup of coffee and piece of paper. He's writing something. It's called Pig's Motivational Thoughts. And his first thought is, always try your best. And then Rat comes over and takes a look at it and scratches out always and writes in, never, never try your best. And he explains, because if you fail, there's no hope for improvement. And Pig's been sitting there listening in, and he says, he has a point. In The Born Loser, poor guy, he's pushing the back of his car, and he says, I'm not getting anywhere. And he hollers, do you have your foot on the brake? His wife says, of course not. She's sitting in the car. He grunts and says, I don't understand it, and continues to push, and it actually like makes him fall to the ground. And his wife says, perhaps if I took it out of park? It also says on here that it's a cartoon from 1989, one of their favorites, to celebrate the Born Loser's 60th anniversary. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.